Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
We'll all agree that better late is better than never. Better late than never is an appropriate motto. Okay? Yeah, hope so. Hi. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. We are, in fact, live. This is the 22nd day of August, 2014. Happy birthday to the long-since departed Dorothy Parker, one of the wittiest women ever to live, one of the wittiest people ever to live. What did she say? I like to drink martinis, two at the very most, three and I'm under the table, four and I'm under the host. She once described the emotional range of Katharine Hepburn as saying her range extends all the way from A to B. Brilliant, brilliant wit. Let's see. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah. Okay. So we've got that taken care of. Good crowd. And thank you. Thank you for the Horn Family Congregation members of the chat room. I sent out a tweet saying that which, of course, went on Facebook as well, saying that we have a likely late start here. The heavens decided to open, and therefore the interweb tubes decided to stop working. Hey. But thanks, everybody, for hanging around and not giving up. I do appreciate it. It means a lot. So good evening to the chat room. Good evening, Anatole and Bean and Devin and John and Jugapunch and M. Brandt and Paul and Sentient Being and Tim from L.A. And good evening to our indefatigable, inveterate chat room moderators, Sparky and Lottie. Good evening, one and all. It is, of course, Friday on the front porch on the Horn. And thank you very kindly, Randy. Loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac. Thank you for letting me know. Because I don't have a direct-to-air monitor going back here. If it's working, it's working. But thank you for your patience. It is much appreciated. Let's see. We'll have a 2.5-hour program this evening instead of a 3-hour program. I apologize. I promise I didn't break the internets, but still, I apologize. We closed the program last night in a hole. We fell $110 short last night, and thanks to those who did help out and make it and make it only $110 and not $150. Thank you. So that means that we have a $260 fundraising goal this evening, and it would be nice not to go into the weekend, into the coming Moran Monday, in a hole. So the PayPal button's at headonradionetwork.com, or if you just like to go to PayPal, you can use, the same address is tied to it, bobkincaid@gmail.com via PayPal, and just choose gift, and boom. That way no transfer fees come out of your contribution because, well, honestly, you're not buying anything. Because we're not selling it. And that way you can know for sure that every bit of what you sent got here. Because it all represents a sacrifice. But the hole is at $260 this evening. 26 folks at $10 apiece. 52 folks at $5 apiece. 13 people at $20. On and on and on and on. Now, where do we begin? Okay, so Friday is when we kind of clear out a bunch of the stacks. Things we didn't necessarily get to during the week. And sometimes we carry on a little bit. And we also have our Friday on the front porch round table of ordinary, extraordinary Americans and world citizens. That will be coming up in the next half hour to hour, depending on what kind of feedback I get from Horn Malloy Skype group moderator Sparky. Our happy birthday to Dorothy Parker resonated with Jim. When not at work, her boss asked her why she was in the bar next door. Her reply was, "Someone else is using the pencil." Oh, God, yeah. Is there anybody quite like her out there right now? I've never been a millionaire, but I just know I'd be darling at it. And this is a classic. If all the girls who attended the Yale prom were laid end to end, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. And then this, if you want to know what God thinks of money, just look at the people he gave it to. Some of these lines read like, and Harpo Marx was one of her friends, an occasional member of the Algonquin Roundtable. But some of these read like Groucho. The cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity. And this, of course. I'm never going to be famous. My name will never be writ large on the roster of those who do things. I don't do anything. Not one single thing. I used to bite my nails, but I don't even do that anymore. Yeah, there's the Katharine Hepburn quote. She runs the gamut of emotions from A to B. She also reviewed plays, and I'm trying to find this one particular quote that then this, which would be good for any given prayer meeting Wednesday. You can't teach an old dogma new tricks. Oh, where's the one about all I need is room enough to lay a hat and a few friends? Dorothy Parker was one of the was early in noting the fact that she had had an abortion. Of course, abortion was very illegal back then, but remarking on her abortion. She said, "It serves me right for keeping all my eggs in one bastard." And, of course, she was no fan of Ayn Rand. She was asked at one point in time to give her impression of Atlas Shrugged. She said, "This is not a novel to be tossed aside lightly. It should be thrown with great force." Amen. Some things don't change. And then the classic, she was asked to give a sentence, and this reads like a little Johnny joke. It was a game of "Can you give me a sentence?" She was asked to use the word horticulture in a sentence, and Dorothy Parker responded, "You can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think." That is a quick mind. Just got a note from Tim about something that is said to be breaking.
Hey.
That's the audio from it. We're not going to run it. Because I saw that a couple of days ago, breaking, cop shoots black man in San Francisco. Apparently the black man was unarmed and failed to pay his bus fare. I saw that and went, oh, no. Well, it turns out that's from 2011, 2013. It's very, very old. It was a horror when it happened. It remains a horror in memory. But we must be very, very, very careful because, I don't know, all I can say is I have become, I hope, judicious in the way that I examine things that pop up on Facebook. Because understand, Facebook is not a news site. Now, there are recent studies out there that show that more and more people are getting their news from Facebook. But the problem is, it may not be news. I mean, I tweeted something the other night watching the events unfold in Ferguson. And I've seen likes of it over the last couple of days. I'm going, guys, it's over. I mean, this is 2 days ago. So just be cognizant. I'm not giving any grief to Tim because I responded the same way he did. But you get burned a couple of times and you get a little more careful. And inflammatory stuff goes around. I saw the Powell shooting video. Isaac directed me to it. And, you know, Ferg is 18. I called him in. He's 18. He's old enough to see this. God knows he's seen all kinds of imitation violence in video games and movies and whatnot. I called him in to see the actual Powell shooting video. And when it was over, he was visibly upset, and he said, Dad, why did you have me watch that? And I explained to him, because, son, things can turn around in an instant in this country. I said, now, I want you to ponder the fact that something like this is far less likely to happen to you because of your pale skin. But this is a daily regularity somewhere in the United States of America. The Powell video was particularly it was as awful as any other video of the police gunning down some human being in this country. It was made more shocking by virtue of the fact that, as the narrator of the video makes clear, the individual who wound up getting gunned down in cold blood was not squared away mentally. Apparently he walked into some convenience store, stole two bottles of soda, walked out to the curb, set the bottles of pop down on the sidewalk by the curb, and waited for the cops to arrive. And when the police did arrive, he started yelling at them, shoot me, kill me now, kill me now. Which they eventually obliged him by doing. There was never consideration given to pepper spray or taser or even overpowering with physical force. They pumped, I think, 12 rounds into him before he could even get within 6 feet of them. But these things are inflammatory and can be misleading. Like seeing a video that is from 2 or 3 or 4 years ago and sort of experiencing it in the context of something that is happening in the now. And there are pushes out there to get us to respond or to measure our responses to these sorts of things. You know, of course, that the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or, as I like to think of them, homicidal religious murderers, they put out a video of themselves beheading James Foley, the journalist that had been kidnapped. They did the beheading because it's bloody and gruesome and shocking, and their goal was to make sure that it went around the world lightning fast on social media. They wanted people to see that. And a lot of people acceded to their desires. The family, on the other hand, of James Foley, put out a request to the wider world saying, please don't share this video. Don't do what these killers want. Twitter instituted a suspension for people who were using that graphic footage. Now, do you remember a few weeks back? We discussed the story of the Israeli embassy in Ireland who posted images of defaced cultural icons from Western Europe. They used Photoshop or whatever to do it, but they, for instance, they defaced the an image of the Mona Lisa with the stamp on it, Israel today, France tomorrow. Israel is the last frontier of Western civilization. Remember? And they defaced, they put the big black beekeeper suit on the Molly Malone statue in Ireland. Israel today, Ireland tomorrow. Israel is the last bastion of Western civilization, or on the front lines, or you know, some such crap. They did something nasty to the Little Mermaid, and then, in irony of ironies, they defaced an image of the David, their own cultural hero, and turned him into some sort of suicide bomber or something. Israel today, Italy tomorrow! In an attempt to inflame Europe against Muslims. Well, I thought that was pretty awful. But never mind, it can always get worse. None other than Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from his personal at Israeli PM Twitter account tweeted a photograph from the execution of James Foley. Really, I'm not kidding. There's no sense in making this up. I have no interest in making this up. No, it's real. The Huffington Post reporting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faced widespread criticism Thursday for using an image from the video of the killing of a U.S. reporter in a tweet that aimed to criticize Palestinian militants. Now, we all understand, do we not, that Islamic State is not the same as Hamas. They're not. Now, if you put them in a room together, they would probably get busy slaughtering each other for the heretics that they each think the other are. This is in the way of the problem with religion, and particularly the monotheistic ones. It's like the Christians. Do you believe in rapture naked or rapture clothed? Rapture clothed. Die, heretic! So the Foley family expressly asked that images of their son's murder not be tweeted or Facebooked or shared on social media so as to deny the murderers the satisfaction that they derived from having their act of barbarity publicized. But that doesn't apply, I guess. Rules of common decency don't apply to Benjamin Netanyahu, who rode the beheaded body of James Foley in a tweet. Netanyahu's purpose was to say that, I guess that Hamas and Islamic State are the same, but they're not. It is an affront to common decency. It is an assault on the senses, and it is absolutely something that I am not at all surprised that Bibi Netanyahu would do. A number of Twitter users were disgusted by what Netanyahu's office did. Of course, Netanyahu then tried, his people, once they got caught, you know, you can't unring a bell, and they deem it far better to ask forgiveness than permission. Once they got caught, they deleted it. But not before it had been seen. A few Twitter responses. Would it be too much to ask for some respect for the Foley family at Israeli PM? Yes, that is too much. It is too much to ask for some respect for the dead. Another Twitter user. Wow, highly inappropriate and insensitive to use James Foley's image and murder to push your propaganda. Despicable. And it is. Despicable. Add PM of Israel to the list of those using pics of James Foley being beheaded for low-end politicking. But see, there are no rules of common moral ethical decency that apply to Bibi Netanyahu. He is simply above it all. Social media can be a powerful tool. It can also be a disgusting weapon. Oh, what else? What else? How about a little how about a little Pat Robertson fun? Just because we had rather a somber prayer meeting Wednesday and we didn't get to any of the ordinary lunacy. By the way, thanks to our buddy Sergi, who cut out my Jeremiad against Pastor John Starr. Well, everybody but me, Hagee, and put it up on YouTube. Thank you. Thank you, Sergi. Now, you may recall that the last time we heard from Marion Robertson, he was trying to warn America against the onslaught of giant black men by way of justifying the homicide of Michael Brown. Well, now he's mad at a different black man. I mean, Michael Brown's dead, right? And, yeah. But in the universe of former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson, there's always some dark-skinned person to be mad at.
You know something? The government isn't efficient. Surprise, surprise. How did you come to that brilliant conclusion? They don't do anything right.
Well, except Social Security, building roads. I'm looking at Pat here. You know who he looks like? I just realized it. It just dawned on me. He looks like Pinky. From Pinky and the Brain. What are we going to do tonight, Brain? He's got the beady little eyes, a funny little mousy face. But I love this clip because it gives me an opportunity to go somewhere that I really enjoy going.
And this old...
Hang on. Dang it. How do I hate thee, Windows 8? Let me count the ways.
Thing, the government isn't efficient. Surprise, surprise. How did you come to that brilliant conclusion?
Yeah.
They don't do anything right.
What is the government... ever done for us, huh? Yeah.
They bled us white and bastards. They've taken everything we had. And not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labor the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct? What? The aqueduct?
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine.
Education. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we've really misread. The Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
You get the idea. All you got to do is take that Monty Python Life of Brian clip and transpose it with Pat Robertson, and what's the government ever done for us? Last I checked, Pat Robertson's a big old hawk. He likes to send the United States military all over the world to bleed and blow up and get killed and kill other people and destabilize entire regions. That's the government, Pat. That's not that, and they're pretty efficient at it, aren't they? But why ruin a perfectly good thesis, right?
Here has been a massive disaster.
Wait, what's been a disaster?
Surprise, surprise. How did you come to that brilliant conclusion? They don't do anything right. And this Obamacare has been a massive disaster. 1/6 of the American economy, and this man, with his socialist tendencies, wanted to take control of it, the federal government, and they are messing it up. He lied. If you like your health care, you can keep it a lie. If you like your doctors, you can keep them another lie. Now, doctors have another problem.
Kind of interesting to hear a guy who looks into the camera and says that a woman with a bum tooth has just had her toothache healed, calling somebody else a liar. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Coming down from big government. As Caitlin Burke reports, it could be bad enough to put your family doctor completely out of business.
The small town of Farmville, Virginia, has two private practitioners, or what we used to know as family doctors. And one of them, Dr. Lawrence Varner, is considering closing his doors after more than 20 years of service. Government intervention into the healthcare system was supposed to improve patient care. Instead, doctors say they feel like clerks, stuck behind their computers instead of taking care of their patients. One example of that government intervention is electronic medical records, or EMR.
Really? Electronic medical records? Making it possible, say, let's say you're not in Farmville, Virginia, if that really is a place. Sounds like a suburb outside of Townville where the Powerpuff Girls live. Let's say you have a problem and you're not in Farmville, or maybe it's 2:00 in the morning and kindly old Dr. Who's is here, isn't up and about. Well, golly gee, if you've got electronic medical records, you can open them up, say, over there in Townville where you're at the emergency room, and they can find out maybe that you're allergic to penicillin before they kill you with some. Or that you're allergic to morphine, or Rocephin, or before they kill you with it. Electronic medical records.
As part of the 2009 stimulus package, physicians received incentives to convince them to buy into EMR. The system promised to make their lives easier. But according to Varner's wife, Linda, it's done the exact opposite.
We need a revolution in this.
Wait, where's Linda? How has it made it the exact opposite, huh? Well, maybe they'll cut back to Linda in a minute after the liquor supply officer's gotten his licks in.
That's it.
We need a revolution in this country to change this stuff. You know,
hold on. Now, just because I don't want you thinking that this is some sort of loopy crap that he said back in 2009, or that this is an old clip of Marion. No. That's this week, 2014. Somewhere between the 18th and the 21st. I'm sorry, not between the. It was the 20th. It was the 20th of August, 2014, when Marion said this. The 20th of August, 2014, with a boiling crisis going on in Ferguson, Missouri, over which he has fulminated about terrifying young black giants. He called Michael Brown a giant. Six feet 4 is a giant. Dang. What's Marion? 5'2"? I mean, how do you get a giant out of it? But never mind. With all that going on, Marion Robertson says, we need a revolution in this country. There are words that ought not be tossed around. There are words that should be tossed around like manhole covers are tossed around. There are words you don't use without having a really solemn, thorough understanding of their meaning. Because revolutions are bloody. Very bloody, more often than not. Revolutions are only referred to as revolutions if they are successful. Otherwise, they are referred to as civil wars. And civil wars are the nastiest kind of civil wars. The Roman Republic fell because it could not keep itself out of civil war, starting about 110 BCE. It was one right after another, until the Republic simply collapsed. But Marion wants a revolution. Why? Well, okay, let's be fair. Why does Marion want a revolution?
I had a little procedure, something done, and I'm sitting there, and this nurse is saying, "Well, tell us about this." And she's accessing into the computer. "Well, how many vitamins do you take? Blah, blah, blah. How about something else? Blah, blah, blah. When did you have that?" And she spent forever and ever logging stuff into the computer because that's what they want to do. They want.
Isn't that unthinkable? Pat Robertson, millionaire, billionaire, wants blood in the streets of the United States of America because healthcare professionals bring laptops into examination rooms and actually bother to input data as to what is wrong with you, what your symptoms are, and what your medications are. And in the mind of this Christian, that is sufficient cause to turn brother against brother, father against son, mother against daughter, mother against son, state, county against county, state against state, and have blood as high as the horses' heads in this country. On the other hand, I remember when health is this the last barbaric yawp of the buggy whip generation? Because, see, the only thing
only difference I can, because I remember when the healthcare, usually it would be an LPN or maybe an RN, depending on what kind of facility you're in. We'll sit there with a pen and some paper and write down all of these things, which may or may not later be appropriately and properly transcribed. Yes, Marty, both of these things are referred to as getting a patient history. But, oh, no, 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 no. Not for Pat Robertson. Oh, no. We've got to overthrow the government because somebody wants him to remember how many units of mega vita vegemin he takes every day. Yeah, Devin pointing out, yeah, sure, it's the mark of the beast when they come in there with their computer machine and start clacking and typing away. How do you know they're even writing, typing in what you're saying? Maybe they're typing in, this one doesn't love Jesus enough. Anyway, Pat, do continue.
Is saying, well, tell us about this, and she's accessing in the computer. Well, how about how many vitamins do you take? Blah, blah, blah. How about something else? Da, da, da. When did you have that? And she spent forever and ever logging stuff into the computer because that's what they want to do. They want to have all those records. And you, well, how about me? I'm sick. Help me. Well, that's too bad. We've got to get the records fixed.
You know, and that is so.
Really, that's how it works in Farmville and wherever it is that that Pat goes. Help me! You know what? If you're at the help me stage, you're probably at the ER, not at your family doc. In point of fact, if you walk in the front door of your family doc saying help me, they're going to get the ambulance there, lickety split, and you're going to go say that in the emergency room because they're not at all prepared to deal with that. Almighty.
Logging stuff into the computer because that's what they want to do. They want to have all those records. And you, well, how about me? I'm sick. Help me. Well, that's too bad. We've got to get the records fixed.
You know, and that is so frustrating. Like that lady said in the piece, the work is never done. At least they never see their kids. They never see their family. We're just overrun by all this paperwork.
Imagine the dollar working for 12.
Stop it right now. One, the lady didn't say that in the piece because they cut the piece off. I don't know, maybe that's how this got edited. Maybe she did say it. But nonetheless, we're talking about a doctor's office here. We spend all our time, we never see our families, we eat nothing but ramen. Sometimes not even the flavor boost packet. We're here all night long doing paperwork. Hey, lady. Hire somebody. You're a Republican. You're running a medical practice. Be a job creator. Oh, wait. Oh, it's about the low wages and the non-wages. Wait a minute. Okay, I got it now. Sorry, in a capitalist system, I'm not gonna be real sympathetic to somebody. I never see my children. Not if you're the business owner. Oh hell no. No. There's ways to do that. You could hire more people. Of course, you might not be able to afford the European vacation or the trip to the Bahamas in February or or whatever. But you'll see your family. You'll be with your children. I mean, for good, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing Christians like this, this should be a no-brainer. But see, this isn't about Christianity. This is about, well, you know, because money.
The man and his wife working for a couple dollars an hour.
It socialism.
It isn't right.
Hey, Baha. You want to eat it, huh? Mumble, 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 socialism, mumble, mumble. No, because see, if this was really socialism, they wouldn't be making these complaints because, they'd have adequate staff. Because they'd all be getting paid by the government. You know, the big government that they hate so much. This is one of those damned if you do and damned if you don't situations. I gotta shut up and just hear it all the way through. I'm sorry.
Logging stuff into the computer because that's what they want to do. They want to have all those records. And you, well, how about me? I'm sick. Help me. Well, that's too bad. We've got to get the records fixed.
You know, and that is so frustrating. Like that lady said in the piece, the work is never done, at least
yeah.
You know, they never see their kids. They never see their family. We're just overrun by all this paperwork.
Imagine the dollar working for 12. I mean, the doctor.
No, okay, I'm sorry. I said I wouldn't, but I did anyway. We're talking about electronic records, which means not paperwork. Can these liars just pick one and stick to it? It's either the curse of data entry or the curse of doing paperwork. But if it, and what's this about $2 an hour? Mumble, mumble, $2 an hour, mumble, mumble, socialism, mumble, mumble.
Because that's what they want to do. They want to have all those records. And you, well, how about me? I'm sick. Help me. Well, that's too bad. We've got to get the records fixed.
You know, and that is so frustrating. Like that lady said in the piece, the work is never done, at least
yeah.
You know, they never see their kids. They never see their family. We're just overrun by all this paperwork.
Imagine the dollar working for 12. I mean, a doctor working for $12 an hour and his wife working for a couple dollars an hour.
Socialism.
It isn't right. Ladies and gentlemen, we need a revolution to stop these so-called progressives from destroying this country anymore, but they're getting pretty close to the tipping point. It is not a pleasant scenario.
Am I to understand that progressives made Officer Wilson pump 6 rounds into Michael Brown? What? You, me, us, we, the Horn Family Commune Congregation? We've got our part of this. We're destroying America. One patient at a time. One uninsured person who gets to go to the doctor at a time. We're destroying America. See, if all those uninsured poors were just out there dying like they're supposed to, Pat wouldn't have to sit there while saying, "I'm sick, help me," while someone's doing data entry of his history so that they won't kill him with some drug that makes him... Yeah. I'm sick, help me. Anything, just don't give me the Aricept. And he said it before and he just kind of breezed past it. But this time he banged on the table. We need a revolution in this country. Revolution means bullets. Bullets mean death. Oh, if only he could get the St. Louis County Police to get rolling and head for Washington, D.C., and that one in our White House! Don't you doubt for a minute that Pat Robertson doesn't fall asleep at night praying, 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 and lusting a little bit, and, well, I don't know, maybe he's past some of those other things. Maybe he's had dreams about how it's the body of Barack Obama laying in the middle of the street and not Michael Brown for 4 hours on end. Because, see, that's the fantasy. That's the yearning. That's why there are more threats against the President of the United States since 2008 than any other president ever. Really. This guy claims an audience of 1 million people. And some significant portion of them are people who actually agree with him. I think another portion of Pat's audience are stoners who are just kind of goofing on watching him. And then that one lonely soul over there at Right Wing Watch who has to take one for the team every time the show comes on. Yeah. Oh, where did I see it today? Talk about a view into the sick and twisted minds of the right wing. There is a crowdfunding campaign out there in support of Darren Wilson. It has raised thus far over $100,000. Mm-hmm. Really? But what's fun about it? Nah, it ain't fun. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not $100,000. It's $150,000. And it lets people leave messages, this crowdfunding campaign does. It lets people leave messages as to why they have contributed to the crowdfunding campaign. And what a Lulu. Because they're not shy, these right-wingers. And these are saying, you want a revolution, Pat? I want a revolution, too. Mercy sakes. These are some serious, serious... psychopaths. Donations are complete. The organizer has stopped donations because they raised $234,910 by 5,901 people in 5 days. No kidding. These are people who support leaving a dead body in the streets for more than 4 hours on a hot August afternoon in Missouri. Good God. And the things, oh, the things they've said. I mean, wow.
trying to. I've seen a couple of screenshots of it. I was trying to find it. But, we don't need it. It's the usual sort of Klan kind of stuff. I don't think there's been a crowdfunding campaign. Well, I suppose you have heard by now that the funeral for Michael Brown will be held Monday. And there has been a bit of a controversy, or a struggle at least, to figure out a venue large enough for it. The last time something like this was dealt with was, and I mean close to one-to-one, apples-to-apples comparison similarities, was the funeral of Emmett Till. And I'm not going to inject myself into what's coming, except to say that Emmett Till's mama, way back then, insisted upon having an open casket funeral, saying, "I want everybody to see what they did to my baby." Do you think that could happen in 2014 America? Because I don't. I don't. The St. Louis County Police Department would probably be waiting outside with the tear gas if they did that. I'm sure. Well, I'm not going to go all Alex Jones and tell you what I'm sure of, because I'm not sure of it. The funeral will be a painful affair. Painful indeed. A little reminder for anyone listening live. On the webpage it still says the old phone number, 304-658-3333. That's not available now because of the problem we have with the dead $4,000 telephone processor. If you want to reach the program, you need to dial 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178, and if you want to participate that way, you need to do it sooner rather than later, simply because we'll be going to the Friday on the Front Porch roundtable of Ordinary Extraordinary Americans, and we can't do phone and Skype group at the same time. I don't know why, but that's just it's technically impossible. Let's go to the phones briefly and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Diane from Kansas.
Oh, hi, Diane. How are
you?
Hi.
Bob, I called the wrong number. That was me.
Oh, okay. Well, no worries. I mean, I'm not trying to be cranky. I'm just trying.
Oh, no. I called it so that you would give the. I thought this is the wrong number, but Bob will give the right number after I call. So, excuse me for doing it that way.
No, that works perfectly.
Yeah, that was actually my thought. So, and you did so right away. So, thanks for doing that.
Well, I'm just tickled to hear from you.
Well, I discovered your program about a year and a half ago, and have listened steadily ever since. And it's part of my daily life. Yeah, at least on most days. I really appreciate your program, and all your callers.
Well, that is, to say the least, Diane, that is gratifying to hear. And thank you so much for being a part of what is keeping us on the air. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. I thought I'd give a brief report from on the ground in Manhattan, Kansas. And I had no intention of calling in tonight. I listen, especially looking forward to Friday on the Front Porch, but, you know, I had no thought of calling in. But, you know, university life is starting up here in Manhattan, Kansas.
It's that time of the year, yes.
With, you know, Kansas State, just around the bend from me. And I was actually driving home from the university and saw something very unusual for Manhattan, Kansas. And that was about, well, about 40 students kind of crammed into an island near the intersection I was going through with signs and yelling. And I slowed down as much as I could to read the signs and hear the chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot." And I can tell you from Manhattan, Kansas, this is something.
Well, I'm guessing that is almost unheard of in Manhattan, Kansas.
It is. I rolled the window down and gave a thumbs up. I couldn't stop or slow down in the middle of the intersection with the flow of heavy traffic from the university. But it is very unusual. When Occupy was in full force, we had one student set up a tent in that same island. And when there were protesters against the invasion of Iraq, we had the same small group of aging activists with their signs out. But they're not taken seriously, and there's not a lot of energy. And I hate to be pejorative, but that's just how it's.
Well, I mean, that's kind of Kansas, isn't it, Diane?
I'm still trying to figure out Kansas. But it's almost like, what, I don't know, is there such a thing as Midwest Gothic? I mean, I know there's that painting, you know, of the farmer with his wife and the pitchfork just pointed upwards. You know that painting? I can't describe it any better, but every time
American Gothic.
So it is actually called, okay, Gothic is in the title. That kind of energy is unusual here. The vibe runs, it seems passive. It seems like this is a passive culture, but there are some deeply held feelings, I think, underneath it all. But this was just something I've not seen in my 17 years of living here. I haven't experienced that energy, that forceful energy. I was glad to see it suffice.
Well, may I ask, Diane, without and I don't want to make any implication out of this or anything, but was it a cross-cultural or cross-ethnic mix of people?
Oh, that was another surprise. No. The African-American students have arrived on campus already, apparently, and have found each other. That was my thought. Yeah.
I'm hoping that some momentum will be maintained, and it's important. It's important for people who aren't of who aren't of color to stand up in this too, because one of the things that we're learning is that and people from as diverse backgrounds as Charlie Pierce on the one hand and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the other have both opined that this is not a race thing, this is a class thing.
Exactly. Well, I think the light bulb may go off here about that at some point. You'd think with the populace, you know, history.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go, Diane, because this could be Kansas has not always been a quiet and banal place, to say the least.
All right.
It was
Bleeding Kansas.
It was Bleeding Kansas was its origin, and then you get, I mean, the very origins of populism and progressivism begin in places like Kansas, and specifically Kansas. I think a lot of social engineering, if you will, was done in the years after that to make sure it didn't bubble up again. But it is bubbling.
If it happens here, it's real.
Yeah, yeah. If it happens in Kansas, then that means that things are really beginning to thump somewhere else.
That's why I called in, because when I saw that, I thought, "Wow, I'm you know, this some interpretation, but nothing else has stirred this here." And well, you know, there was one thing I saw, and it's not in the same class, but I'm going to mention it because it just annoyed me so much, and that is now and then I'd run into that ridiculous Phelps group.
Oh, dear God.
I mean, once on campus and once when I was walking in the park, and I mean, we're not talking about the same thing here, except, I mean, general concern about the rights of other human beings in both cases, but that was the only time I would see some gathering with some energy. That's my point. And I had a really difficult time when I was walking in the park and the city park in the middle of this town, and they were all grouped on the grass by the street, and the sidewalk was on the other side of that grass. And I'm walking on the sidewalk. I can almost touch them. There's three police cars on the other side of the street just sitting there. I'm like, why, in case there's any trouble, you know. And I had to restrain myself from punching one of them, which surprised me because I don't usually have that impulse.
No, I was kind of talking about that a couple of nights ago. It's really off-putting personally to one's personal integrity when one begins to feel those things.
Oh, is that when Captain Mary called?
Well, that's why Captain Mary called.
Right.
Because you just feel like you want to fly home and bathe in bleach.
Ugh. I just wanted to hit them with a baseball bat or something, and I thought, well, this will look good, you know. This will look real good for me if I do that. I mean, ethics professor slams.
Right, I was going to say the faculty senate meeting will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I thought no. I mean, not that I had a lot of time to think about it, but
well, tangentially, you know. Diane, did you? I saw some bit of, and again, take it with a grain of salt. But these fools from Westboro have said that they're going to Iraq to protest the Islamic State.
Phelps' daughter and company?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I read earlier today. Maybe it's onion material. I don't know.
They're going to Iraq to protest.
Well, right, and see if it turns out that that is true, Diane, I'm going to get all Shakespearean and say, "Stand not upon the order of thy going, but go at once."
I mean, yeah, just put yourself in the place of all that danger, and what would their purpose be? I think I missed what you said.
Well, no, they said they were going to go and protest the Islamic State, you know, because they're a bunch of hell-bound heathens or something. I'm thinking there's a bunch of progressives out there that say, you know, I'll contribute.
Can we help you get
the plane tickets?
Yeah, better not to be in a small park in the middle of the country where we're all peaceful and walking dogs and jogging. Better to be over there.
Right, because those three police cruisers that you referenced, Diane, those police cruisers were there to make sure that nobody came and ball-batted the Westboro people.
Yeah, that's what I was when I had that impulse. And it's just, you know, it's a little bit sinister to see that. Like, it was a visceral reaction, like, okay, their presence is for the first time about presence in this little park, you know. So, but they were on campus once. I was walking on campus once, and there they were on the sidewalk. And I was new faculty then, but if I, you know, if that had been later, even 5 years later, I would have known what to do. I would have picked up the phone and called the public affairs in the president's office and asked what in the world here. And does the university approve? And I would have just had some questions.
Without a doubt. But see, that's the other part of the gig that Westboro has run so effectively, Diane. Many people don't understand that before he ever started this shtick, Fred Phelps, who has now gone to his long home, was a lawyer.
Right.
And he specialized in civil rights cases in which he got attorney's fees. And so every time somebody delivers a member of the Westboro Baptist Church, and his daughter, Shirley Phelps Roper, has followed in his footsteps. She, too, is a lawyer. And so every time somebody delivers them a cold cup of coffee, they file a lawsuit, and the insurance company invariably settles.
Oh, so in this case, maybe the insurance estate would have had to settle.
Bingo.
Perhaps.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't see him on campus after that, so I don't know. There was that one time, but then they pop up in the park, but they seem to have a very... I was assuming that they were on that slice of grass by the, because they weren't allowed anywhere else. I could be wrong. I was thinking, the have told them they can't block our sidewalk in the park. You know, I was thinking that maybe that jammed in on the grass, but I don't know.
They can't do that, but by the same token, they're always looking for another, because it's basically a family cult, and it's the only way they make money. It's not like somebody's out there working for a living. They just sit there and live on these attorney's fees.
Yeah, parasites that they are. And, you know, that reminds me, it's really not related to this conversation, except that it is religious and in Kansas, but down the road where I'm at and where the university is at in Manhattan, there's a place called St. Mary's. And I read that there's a renegade, I think I have this right, I think I read it in Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, Thomas Frank.
Yes.
There's a kind of sect, I guess it's a sect in St. Mary's, that has separated from the Orthodoxy and has proclaimed their own Pope in St. Mary's, Kansas. Every time I think I know, can't understand Kansas, something else like that pops up.
Oh, without a doubt.
And just within this kind of thread of weirdness, there's a place out in western Kansas called the Garden of Eden. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's where this man, this older man, had married a younger woman, much younger. And when he died, he put his body under glass, and it's placed in his yard, and people go and look at it. So when I say I haven't figured out Kansas, I really haven't. Because that's weird.
Well, yes, it is.
That's just weird. Of course, I remember when I lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, someone told me that at one time in downtown Pittsburgh, and maybe you know that, know this, given your relationship to the bird, that people would, there's a mortuary where they'd lay out dead people in the window, and Pittsburghers would just stroll by on a Saturday night and look.
Yeah, yeah.
You knew that.
No, yeah, I'd heard that. The Berg is the Berg is the Berg is the Berg.
Yeah,
Andy Warhol would never have been Andy Warhol had he not grown up in Pittsburgh.
Now, that's an interesting comment. Why do you say that? Because I find that very interesting.
Well, because Pittsburgh had multiple dynamics going on at the same time. You can be in one little neighborhood And there's the Italian American Society club building. You can walk two blocks, and there's the Serbian Society.
Yeah.
Another block and a half, and it's the Croatian Society.
Mm-hmm.
And then also within Pittsburgh, during a certain period of time, you had one of the single most vibrant African American owned sections of business in the entire country.
And you had a blossoming
of journalism. You had a flowering of culture, the music culture that comes up, and it's all done against this background of industrial monstrosity.
Mm-hmm.
The place is just.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the geography and the indigenous history that goes with all of it. You can't help but have just strange and wonderful things coming out of that place.
You can't be unidimensional there, can you? Really, if you're paying attention. You have to fragment into many selves or something like that.
Well, yeah, and then there's that classic old joke about the difference between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia.
Well, what is that?
If you're in Pittsburgh and you're walking down, let's say you're walking down Forbes Avenue in Pittsburgh,
yeah.
And you look at a guy and you go, you got the time? The guy goes, yeah, 1:45. You need a watch?
Yeah.
And if you do it in Philadelphia, the guy looks at you and goes, what do I look like? Big F and Ben, get a watch, you loser.
It's so true. And you know, another thing about Pittsburgh, I went from Kansas to Pittsburgh in this discussion mainly because I moved from Pittsburgh back to Kansas, so I'm always comparing the two. But, you know, in Pittsburgh, my experience was that people exchanged directions to places like they would exchange recipes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
I absolutely. See, my formative college years were spent in a fraternity house at West Virginia University that was largely dominated by a bunch of guys from Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
So since I had a vehicle at the time, I wound up driving a lot. Hey, can you give me a ride up to, you know, to Mount Leb? And, you know,
uh-huh.
70, and so I got to know Pittsburgh that way and all those, because it's not geographically amenable to, like, the layout of a Midwestern city.
Yeah.
It's a lot more, Pittsburgh is, to me, a lot more West Virginia than Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Because,
hollers.
Yeah, you gotta go up over a holler, you gotta go, mm-hmm. and this side of the river and that side of the river, and.
Yep.
Yeah.
People get very nested there like that, and I loved that aspect of Pittsburgh. I moved there from Virginia Beach, which I thought had no community because, you know, there's military, there's the tourists, and then there's the Virginians who feel they're native and kind of close in. And I had no complaints. I just didn't find a sense of community. I drove into Pittsburgh, and I thought I had reached heaven. I could feel it. I could feel it just by looking at what I was driving through and how things were laid out. But, you know, Bob, you know what the stupid white people did there?
What?
And they did this in Norfolk too, I've heard, and probably other places. You know that wonderful, vibrant African-American community you were speaking of?
Right, right.
Okay. I think you were talking about Liberty, but I might have said.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
So, and I lived in Shadyside, so I was next to Liberty and Squirrel Hill and Bloomfield, you know, a lot of different things, you know, going on, like you've said. Well, Liberty, they did this thing where they put, I don't know what it's called, but you know, people used to be able to get off the bus. I'm told this. By the time I moved to Pittsburgh, it had, you know, this thing had been done. Whereas people used to just be able to get off the bus and walk into Liberty, like one could get off the bus and walk anywhere in Pittsburgh to almost anything. They put one of these circles around Liberty so that people couldn't, it kind of posed a barrier.
Yeah, it was almost like a Caesarian siege wall.
Ooh, a a cesarean siege wall.
Yeah, like
I've
the,
never heard of that.
Yeah, like the it was called circumvallation, what Caesar would do around a Gallic city.
Oh, and what was the same effect there? People wouldn't come in? Is that
what, right. Nobody comes in, nobody goes out.
Right. And so that's what they did to Liberty. That's what I'm told, and certainly I saw it and drove on it. So, and I think it came from a city planning kind of, maybe a trend in city planning out of the 1970s. I'm not sure because I wasn't there. But someone told me that the effects of that, like in Norfolk and Liberty and elsewhere, was to isolate those formerly vibrant communities and especially make, like, the suburban whites nervous about the whole thing.
Yeah, well, and to make sure that nothing spread outward and yeah. But one of the things I admire most about Pittsburgh is the fact that it could have just gone the way of the Rust Belt.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There was enough leadership in that city to make it want to pick itself up from the ashes of the collapse of the steel industry and be something else. And it is something else.
It's a renaissance city, truly, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll never forget back when I think it was maybe it was the third Netroots Nation they'd had. And I went up there, and we were the first. The Horn was the first organization to suggest to them, you know, you might want to make this stuff available to people who can't get here. So we broadcasted a bunch of stuff, Guy James and I and a couple of others did, from that Netroots Nation in Pittsburgh. And in the evening, people would go out, and the baseball stadium in Pittsburgh is magnificent. I mean, just
the new one?
The new one's beautiful, the view.
When they exploded the other one.
It's got all the boondoggle aspects of breaking the back of a city for a in tax breaks for a bit. But anyway, we happened to be walking down the street, Guy James and I did, and we Guy and I are forever looking for somewhere to eat. And
Pittsburgh's great for that.
Oh, so we just happened to hear music, and we wander in to this Cubano restaurant, and it was apparently dance night, too. So Guy and I just took a little table over in a corner, and I mean the music was loud, and it was you would have sworn you were sitting in Havana.
Well,
I mean, with the dressing,
dressing
up to go out dancing and everything, and I mean, and you know what the costumes are like, and it was just wonderful.
I was in a coffee shop near Shadyside, well, actually more near Bloomfield, just a small group, and Donovan. And that was that was 17 years ago. It wasn't recently, but, you know, nice little gatherings there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, of course, I've been to concerts up at the Civic Arena. And, wow.
I wrote to you about the Syrian Mosque because I know you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was beautiful.
Beautiful.
And it's a parking lot now?
Well, yes, I believe it. I know they blew it up because I was there in the next neighborhood and part of the crowd protesting it. But and as I recall, it was for the university in a parking lot. Yeah, I do have another question. I have a question for you about Pittsburgh. You knew that when the GA, who met there? The G8 or?
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You remember, kind of circling back to, the reason I called was to report on what was happening here in Manhattan with the energy and the forceful anger against the situation that is in Ferguson. It's Ferguson, right? Missouri?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. As I recall, I had already moved to Kansas by the time this happened, but I still recall when Prince Charles came into town, in Pittsburgh to look at city planning and stuff. But when I heard of this G8 situation, there were reports all over, as I'm sure you saw, that the police were at Carnegie Mellon University.
The city was in complete lockdown.
And that little old woman walking out of department stores, downtown, you can see that picture easily, right? We're accosted by the police. And that people in neighborhoods near Well, I used to live where subjected to those sound bombs or whatever they're called.
Mm-hmm.
They hurt the children's ears. And I was like in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, and you know what? Pittsburghers did not take kindly to it.
Well, I hope not. I would assume not. They're used to decent, well, more than decent neighborhoods. I think Pittsburgh, I mean, it's really no wonder Fred Rogers came out of Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And the first National Public Radio station was down the street from where I lived on, you know.
And then there's always KDKA, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody thinks about the, and I think maybe there
That's
are two
right.
or three other stations, but you know, all the other stations that whose call signs begin with K are west of the Mississippi. But KDKA was the first. It was just the first.
Oh, I actually interviewed on there once when that Enron scandal broke and I came into town, and for some reason the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette interviewed me about it, and it was a thing, and the radio station picked up on it, so I interviewed with KDKA, had a nice experience, and I just was very glad to be part of, you know, some coverage in Pittsburgh, because it's one of my favorite cities, and they were paying attention to subjects like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette framed the whole corporate scandal thing. I mean, the title on the article on the front page they gave was something like "Professor Criticizes Corporate Power." I mean, what else can you say?
Yeah. Well, but see, Diane, you've touched on something here, and I think it's kind of worth going into the reporting that we've had, because a lot of America was shocked to see these MRAPs and tanks and snipers and machine guns rolling into Ferguson, Missouri. And a lot of people looked up and went, well, where the hell did they come from?
Mm.
But it turns so people did the research, and a lot of this, you know, this isn't necessarily a result of our bloody misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. This goes back to the Clinton administration.
Oh.
And this goes back to community policing, and the militarization of the police starts in the mid-1990s. And what comes out of that? Well, some people, especially on the progressive side of things, still remember Seattle in 1999.
Oh, sure. Sure. Oh,
and that,
yeah.
You know, and that turned into a police riot.
World Trade Organization, yeah.
And that's
yeah.
and that's when, you know, that's they, you know, they rolled up with their tear gas and their machine guns and their sniper rifles and their armored vehicles and yada yada yada, and just yeah. escalated things completely out of control. So there's actually a continuum.
Yeah.
It starts in the mid-90s, and and most of that stuff is war surplus from the first Gulf War.
Is that right?
And
so there's a link to corporate world right there.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got, and it, because you got to, it's expensive enough to carry this stuff over. It's,
yeah.
It's every bit as expensive to carry it back. And you don't dare leave it laying on the ground, because now we've learned, I mean, we've seen the footage, assuming that the media aren't lying to us. We, or particularly the Pentagon, we've seen the footage of ISIS, ISIL, Iraq, Islamic State, whatever they are, going up and down the roads in our trucks and with people carrying our weapons.
Yeah.
Because we armed up the pathetic Iraqi military and the Iraqi police, all of whom at the advance of IS, literally tore their uniforms off. And threw their guns down, and all you could see of them were butts and elbows.
What a mess! What a predictable.
So you
mess.
Bring that stuff home. What are you gonna do? Send it to the recycling center after you've spent so much blood and American blood and treasure on it? No, give it to the police. You know, it's the life cereal. You know, give it to Mikey.
This is illuminating, Bob. Do you think this was by executive order within the framework of administrative discretion, or do you think the Congress got involved in this during the Clinton years?
I can't speak with certainty, but
yeah.
I think the Congress was involved because there was later on I saw another story that showed that if you compare members of Congress who support the militarization of the police versus those who don't, the ones who support militarizing the police get significantly higher defense industry contributions.
Oh, dear God. Well, it's a fascist trap.
Well, sure it is. I mean, you said it perfectly. It is exactly that. And what you wind up with
is a militarized police who doesn't understand why people would feel put off by having militarized police. I mean, there's still enough people of a certain age and of enough of the generation who remember the idea of a beat cop.
Yeah.
You know, bless his heart, he's gone now, but one of my favorite old Robin Williams skits was something where he was talking about, he said, you know, can you imagine an Islamic terrorist in a neighborhood in New York? He said, the beat cop will just want, give me that gun, get out of here.
Gosh. Yeah, you can see it. Well, you know, in Pittsburgh, I was sitting outside having pizza on Ellsworth Avenue once, and the police on a horse just clomped right by, stopped, asked us stuff, how are you doing? And he just asked us stuff like, how's your night? And,
yeah.
And clomped on,
yeah.
A horse.
And of course, if you haven't spent any time in Washington, D.C. lately, that place is an embarrassing armed camp.
Oh, is it?
Maybe I got a little desensitized to it by virtue of the time that I was spending there. But, you know, we'd walk out of our little basement apartment and go on to do meetings on the AIC Act over on the House side. We were on the Senate side. And you'd walk past, by the time you got from point A to point B, you'd walk past 50 police officers. And they'd all be standing there with their semi-automatic rifles. You know the way they carry them now? They kind of prop up against their chest so they can just swing them around and start shooting.
Oh God!
And you know, children walking by, and they were just sort of fixtures or background pieces until somebody would say something into a radio, and then boom. I mean, it was immediate. My colleague Bo was up there the day the mentally ill woman went on the automobile rampage, and well, it wasn't even rampage.
Yeah. Shot her dead.
Yeah, they wound up shooting her dead.
They have to shoot everyone dead. I mean, you just step in outside the zone of some acceptable something, and you have to be dead.
Yeah.
You know, God. Yeah.
And, you know.
You were there that day, Bob?
I wasn't there. My colleague was.
Oh, Bo was there. Okay.
Yeah. But we saw other stuff. We saw a truck try to go where trucks aren't supposed to go, and I mean those steel barriers just sprung up out of the asphalt instantaneously.
Uh-huh.
And the next thing you knew, there were six Capitol cruisers. Bang, they were right there.
Yeah. Let me guess, because our House and Senate and White House are so worth preserving and protecting.
Well, they,
right?
Because,
I say with irony and dripping with sarcasm.
Yeah. No, it's exactly it. I mean, all of this is... the vast majority of this is post 9/11 stuff, Diane.
Ugh.
And it is indicia of a country that is scared to death of everything.
I think those people in the House and Senate must be scared of everything, and the Supreme Court justices, they get their buffer zone. So
yeah.
I guess they think they're so important to protect, and they're so precious. That's just the picture I'm getting from what you just told me.
They live in constant fear.
And they're so distrusted by, from what I can tell on the polling, you know, the polling on how do you,
yeah.
You know, the legitimacy of the House, Senate, and the judicial.
But Diane, you have to balance that against, you know, not some 6'7" Islamic fundamentalist with a portable dialysis machine in a cave in Pakistan. Not against that, but you have to balance it against, say, a bunch of goobers from the South who want to bring their guns and march around Washington, D.C. That was 4th of July last, remember?
I do remember. And, you know, there's just some kind of disconnect in thinking that the senators and, you know, representatives would want that there where they are. You see what I mean? It's strange.
Well, it is, and I mean, there are object lessons out there. One of the people that we got to sign on to the AIC Act was Representative Keith Ellison, for whom I have profound respect.
Michigan?
Minnesota.
Minnesota, or?
Yeah, he's from I think Minneapolis or St. Paul.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But the on nice days when they're in session, they will walk down the steps of the House side of the Capitol and back over because it's just a lovely day. And people who lobby and want stuff done and things like that know to sort of gather out there, and it's an opportunity to have a one-on-one with the actual representative because you don't get that very often.
Yeah.
So lo and behold, we saw Keith Ellison coming out, and Ferg was with me. And Ferg goes, "Dad, that's Keith Ellison." I said, "Yeah." He said, "We want him on the bill, right?" I said, "Yeah."
Mm.
And he's all eager. I think he was maybe 15 at the time or something. And I can see him kind of rearing up to go a running. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I told him he had to slow down.
I horse collared him and said, "Don't run at the congressman. These people with guns are dangerous."
Oh, my God.
And so he walks very quickly instead. And I walked with him, and, you know, the old gray-haired guy, you know, can't possibly be a threat. And we explained things to the Congressman Ellison, and the next thing you know, the very next day, he signed onto the bill. But no, I mean, I think when you cross into Washington, D.C., it should say, you know, "Welcome to Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, no sudden moves."
You see the paradox I'm seeing where I have this picture that so many people in that House are empowering and egging on the very people who could show up with guns and surround their precious structures. Maybe I'm seeing too much in that, but, you know, I'm seeing that those guns may be pointed at them, and they're the ones, you know, going along with the NRA and catering to their, what would you call the teabaggers, the right rump or whatever.
Oh, well, no, I call them mainstream Republicans now, Diane.
Oh, my God.
You know from logic, you know, you tell me I'm wrong. Give me a compelling argument that I'm wrong.
No, I can't, because I grew up in a Republican family who voted for Eisenhower, and now I, you know, see how things have shifted, you know?
Yeah, but see, that's a different kind of Republican, Diane. There's that wonderful John Prine song, "Grandpa Was a Carpenter," where he sings, "And he voted for Eisenhower because Lincoln won the war."
That's
a different kind of Republican.
Yeah.
I think we remarked last night, you know, Eisenhower could not get elected.
He couldn't get nominated by
the Republican Party. Lincoln couldn't. Nixon couldn't. Reagan couldn't. Ford couldn't. Dole couldn't. George H.W. Bush couldn't get nominated for the presidency by the Republican Party of 2014. Yeah.
So that's why when you say mainstream Republican, you're just saying that teabaggers are equal to mainstream Republican, like they're all silly fascist extremists.
Yeah,
that's the bulk of them.
Yeah,
that's the middle of them.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I mean, this is a party that has gone to the extreme right of Barry Goldwater.
Oh.
You know, Barry Goldwater, who in 1964, you know, he had that slogan, "In your heart, you know he's right."
Yeah, my mom liked Goldwater. Yeah.
But the other side responded, "But in your gut, you know he's nuts."
Yeah.
And he was.
He didn't mind anything about gays in the military. I mean, that's probably your point, that he wasn't that nuts.
Well, he was deemed to be nuts because he thought that there might be a time when somebody really needed a proper nuking.
Oh yeah.
He was going to go toe to toe. He was going to go toe to toe with the Ruskies.
Yeah.
But
that commercial that
the Daisy Girl.
Yeah. Well, that big, didn't they have to take that ad off in favor of Goldwater? There's a big nuclear bomb going off. I mean, I was too young to know, but
it either ran once or never ran at all. The word just got out about it. It's like, no.
Incendiary, yeah.
But that was the right wing, and to be fair, Diane, that's the right wing that has given birth to this right wing, because Goldwater in 64 didn't just get beat, he got stomped.
Yep.
I mean, he got beat like a barred mule.
You and Mr. Stress talk about that, and I get a big kick out of Mr. Stress talking about how he thought they went away then and how despicable most people thought they were, you know, and now here they are. They're in the middle of it. Well, what you're saying, I guess, is the Republican Party left that opening wide and clear for them.
They wanted it. See, once upon a time, the John Birch Society was deemed to be a bunch of fringe loonies.
Yeah, like LaRouche and, you know.
And, yeah. But I mean, it's there historically. The Powell memo, Lewis Powell writes the Powell memo, and in very short order, he's on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yeah.
But that was the roadmap toward corporate domination of America.
Ugh.
And if you're going to do something like that, you know, our betters in their silk suits, talking with their teeth clenched, are not going to be the ones out in the street hollering for, I say, Muffy, we must have our gun rights back, because it's not going to resonate. You got to have some shock troops in the culture war.
And so
there's a continuum that goes from 1964 to 1968 to 1972, and works its way forward. The silent majority. George Wallace going to send a message to Washington. All of these things play into the hardcore right wing until you get to the modern era, and the John Birchers that were once thought to be loonies are repackaged and rebranded, and lo and behold, they're the teabaggers. It's the same bunch. And libertarianism is having its resurgence.
Oh, that's silliness.
But this is all driven by a yearning for cheap labor and low taxation and, well, you know, the running slogan around here, they want it all. It's all being done by the top 0.1% of the 1%. But they've got to have some willing fools on the ground. Jerry Falwell in 1980 with the Moral Majority is a big part of it. The anti-abortion pro-fetus bunch. I've said it before, but Diane, it's a fact. If tomorrow we ended women's access to reproductive health care across this country, the Republicans would never be able to win another election, even in a congressional district. Because,
not raise money either.
Right, because the little weirdos will go home. This is all, you know, guns is about motivating the weirdos. Anti-abortion is about motivating the weirdos. You got to keep them stirred up. You got to keep them ginned up. It's that old Goering quote about, of course the people don't want war, but you have to tell them that somebody wants to make war against them, and once you've gotten there, you can move them anywhere you want to.
We are in trouble. We are in deep trouble. You know, I think that whole abortion thing, I wasn't in Kansas when it was happening, but according to Thomas Frank, it was and I guess other people would know about this, it was a Wichita thing, Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Where people were laying on the streets in front of cars, and you've got
Bill O'Reilly out there fulminating night after night after night about Tiller the Killer. And of course he pays no price for that, when in fact he may as well have pulled the trigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, isn't it that it's just weird to think that a certain segment of society can stir up the rest. I guess they're just I suspect they're enjoying themselves on some level. Which is a disgusting thing to, you know, think. But if there's more blood on the street, I mean, I think that some of these people will revel in it. What do you think?
Yeah, look, absolutely. No, this is the right wing in this country, Diane. They can see it, they can feel it, they can taste it, they can hear it. It is the America that they think they yearn for is just barely out of their grasp, and that's how you get Pat Robertson sitting there calling. I mean, there Do you think that if I got behind this microphone every evening and called for bloody revolution in America, that they wouldn't come and drag me by the heels out of here?
Uncle Fred would, you know, who's listening now perhaps, would be on it, huh?
Right. Mm. But Pat Robertson can call for blood-sodden revolution in America and the removal of the President of the United States, and, well, you know, that's just another... Because they, you know... It's Orwellian, not in the 1984 sense, but in the Animal Farm sense, Diane.
Yeah.
In that, you know, some Americans are more equal than other Americans.
Well, I guess I'm at Bundy. Was it Bundy Ranch that citizens can just point their guns at the feds and have picture taken, and we're supposed to think that, well, they can do that. You know, I mean, that was an eye opener.
Oh, without a doubt. Federal officers, white people pointing guns.
Yeah.
Nothing gets done.
You know, one thing that comes to mind.
Black folks not pointing guns, you bring out the snipers and the machine
guns. Yeah. Well, you know, there's this big value survey done that, some people, if you teach certain things or research certain things, you'd know about, but not everyone does. But it's just simply, it's called the Hofstede's Value Survey, and it's on the website, and it keeps track of nation states according to dominant values, and the choices are whether the cultures are masculine versus feministic or feminist, and it's on a continuum. But at any rate, the only two countries that come out so noticeably high on individualism, no surprise to you, you already know this, is the U.S. and Australia. And the rest are, you know, as you can, and there's some other value preferences, too, as to how people tolerate power distance and other things. I can't remember them all, but I often think, well, we're so individualistic that if anyone, by all that data and by all what we know, that if anyone just plays to that side of us, it's a done deal. You know, we value individualism so much. And so that's where I think that's why that Ayn Rand story strikes such a chord, don't you?
I agree that... Well, Ayn Rand provides cover for people who wanted and were self-centered to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And because when you're operating on the right wing, I've said before, they haven't had an original idea since abolition, and that one wasn't their idea either.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Republican Party of the Civil War was not right wing. It was actually what we would understand to be left wing.
Mm-hmm.
And everything gets flipped around with the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, and that's when LBJ says we're going to lose the South for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, they never had the South. I don't think LBJ understood that. They just had a titular name for a certain amount of inclusivity for the right wing. But the right wing do not want to do detailed analysis. You know, John Dean wrote extensively about this. They want to be given orders, and they want to have clear-cut objectives for things that they should do, because authority is what the right wing responds to. It's built in. You know, it's not a flaw. It's a feature. Mm. Whereas our side wants to do that kind of detailed analysis, and the right wing makes great sport of us by saying things like, well, they want to have a sensitivity understanding session with Bin Laden.
You know, I often think that the whole Enlightenment project is just what's on the line. You know, I mean, who would crave authority who felt like they were a child of the great philosophers of the Enlightenment period? And even a reading of Adam Smith would show that he was for regulation, and he suspected, you know, monopoly power would be bad and blah, blah, blah. You know, I feel like many of us are actually children of the Enlightenment because we thought there would be some kind of progress ongoing.
And that's the essence of my frustration that I've been feeling for several days now, because I was told as a child that things are getting better.
Yes.
And they were. I don't know how much age differential there is between us, and I'm enough of a gentleman not to ask. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I was born in 1963, and things were getting better. But it moved parabolically, Diane, and in 1980, we peaked.
Yes.
We peaked. Actually, you can back up and you can say we peak. We're at the top of the parabola with the resignation of Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And then we begin the long, slow, irretrievable slide that goes through Jerry Ford and Ronald Reagan and H.W. Bush and, yes, Bill Clinton and W. and, yes, Obama.
Oh, yeah. It's like continuity of whatever that all is, which I think is fascistic. I just don't know any other word to... I don't know.
I use the F word too, Diane, because it's the only one. It's the only one that applies. I mean,
it applies technically, right?
Exactly. It is an adjective. Yeah. It's an adjective, not an imprecation. We are dealing with the marriage of the power of the state and the power of business, and.
Yep.
Everything becomes subservient to those two things.
Yeah.
The question is, and I think it's an open question, based on history as we understand it, is there a way to take power back from fascists without resorting to violence?
Without a World War II and Mussolini being hung in the city square?
I think the more interesting example is Spain.
Oh. Hmm.
Because, you know, Spain, the fascists consolidated power by virtue of the proxy war waged between the Soviets and Germany in the Spanish Civil War. And by the time the Second World War rolled around, the fascists had consolidated power and Spain sat out.
Uh-huh.
And in all the wreckage and the carnage of the aftermath of the Second World War, Spain remained a fascist state.
Yeah.
And it only began inching away from fascism with the death of Generalissimo Francisco Franco.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get to the modern era, and of course one of my favorite moments in the presidential career of George W. Bush, Diane, was when he looked over at Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar and said, "You know what the problem is with the French?
Oh, Lord.
They don't have a word for entrepreneur."
Oh, my God. Never probably saw a French word in his life to say something like that. Well, he's seen many. The point is he doesn't know when he's seeing one.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just the pure, beautiful... The almost Aristotelianly archetypal irony of George Bush complaining that the French don't have a French word for a word he doesn't understand.
Harvard really claim him? Do his professors, you just wonder. I mean, really.
Yes,
an MBA is not the mecca of, I mean, I teach in MBA programs, but I don't think it's the mecca of. It's a cookie cutter thing, you know. So
much of what's wrong with America came out of the Harvard School of Business, doesn't
it? Yep.
The idea of predatory, what I call predatory accounting.
Yeah.
And the idea that you can just flip businesses and put people out of work, and the only thing you've got to do is maximize profit. I mean, there are so many things that need. And I would love to have, perhaps on another date, your thinking on this. I read a fascinating article, for instance, about the divestiture movement where fossil fuels are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a part of it. You know, I traveled to Europe and implored...
Go to the bank to speak to the bank?
Yeah, to speak to the banks and to try to get them to get out of funding mountaintop removal. And that effort continues, and I'm not going to tell anybody that's doing it that they're doing the wrong thing. But... one of the things that's been observed is that when that money dries up, It creates a an economic vacuum into which absolutely unaccountable to anybody, not even God Almighty, hedge funds can step in and happily finance away.
Other projects.
Well, the same projects.
Oh, the same.
You know, let's say.
Oh, there's no accountability.
Yeah,
let's say
Bank of America, for instance, says we're not going to fund Alpha Natural Resources anymore at all.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, that opens it up for, you know, Leviathan Partners LLC hedge fund to do it instead.
Oh, I see. I see.
And there's no board meeting to send a bunch of nuns to say that this is immoral.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm getting at, Diane, is I think that it's systemic. By systemic, I mean that we are playing around inside a capitalist trick box, every time we roll the dice, it may look like seven, but at the last minute, both dice are going to flip over and it's going to be snake eyes.
Boy, that's well put. What a vision. Capitalistic trick box, that's how you put it. That's interesting. Well, maybe on another night we could talk about, because you might have other callers. I don't want to, you know, hog your time. But I'm watching the new Benefit Corporation, the new charter passed in many states.
I'm fascinated with that. And I would love to have your insight on that, Diane.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to track it and even bring someone into campus to talk about it because it's not being talked about. And it's a thing. I mean, it's a real thing. So maybe, I mean, I'm not saying that'll be the solution or, you know, but to what you're talking about in terms of the capitalistic trick box and the hedge funds and the vacuum they would fill if one financial establishment relinquishes their immoral investment, that you're saying that the hedge funds will just pick it up. And I know you're right. You're right. That's what they do. But there's something else bubbling up. And I'd like to get your view on it too. I'm going to do some more research on it, and it's a recent.
I think that development. I have conversations, for instance, with our buddy Dr. John about the future of journalism.
Yeah.
And you know, we're just watching the First Amendment, because when we watch journalism die. We watch the First at least a portion of the First Amendment die. We need to figure out a way to make it possible for professional reporters who actually know and practice a craft to be able to keep the lights on, feed their families, buy tires when tires need buying, without having the gang down in accounting say, no, that's a little too edgy there. You know, that might piss off the people over at Amalgamated Widget, and they buy a lot of advertising, you know.
Yeah. I try not to have anything to do with the corporate news, except dropping in now and then. I feel much better informed since I started to listen every night, or just about every night, too. And if I, you know, if I'm not listening that night, I'm podcasting, you know, so I feel much better informed for listening to your program, because the corporate news, I mean, it's just like the Matrix. I mean, we'd have to be in a trance to just take that in and think that's it. But I guess with the First Amendment, you brought up the First Amendment, you're aware of that situation with the New York reporter that Obama's Justice Department is
attacking. It's atrocious.
I will just say what many of your other, you know, the, what do you call them, our commune?
Horn Family Commune Congregation? Because nobody can agree on which, what we are.
Yeah, what we are, of which I'm one. Many others in that commune have said that, well, how do you put it, I departed from my interest, my positive view of Obama early on, after having voted for him, which doesn't count in Kansas. So, you know,
Diane, I don't know if I ever had one.
You were in reality.
I just have an understanding, and maybe this sounds smug on my part. I don't mean it to.
No,
but maybe
okay.
My understanding is that I live in an empire.
Yeah.
So a couple of thousand years have passed since the last really, really big successful one. There's the British Empire, too. But what we have here is every 4 to 8 years, we try to have a peaceful transition to a new imperial administrator.
Mm-hmm.
But in the final analysis, differences are going to be largely cosmetic.
Yeah.
You might have some ideological differences,
Social issues. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
that's what we're allowed, I guess.
Right. You still got to keep the last vestiges of empire chugging and galumphing along.
Right. And I understand and believe that's true. I read some historian's account of that. I think it was the same professor who wrote Blowback. He wrote about, I'm just blanking on his name, and he died in the past few years, and he was talking about how he was stating the obvious, like we could have war or democracy, you know, and he talked about it within the context of empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, but my particular reason, I got disenchanted with Obama for many reasons, and his vindictiveness against whistleblowers, which apparently is channeled through the Justice Department, unless the Justice Department is just running him, which is entirely possible. When he sent his first press secretary out, who presumably talks for the president, right? And I mean,
yeah,
to some degree. And he made fun of the progressive base that put Obama in office. I'm like, I'm out of this, man.
No. You're thinking about Rahm Emanuel. That was his chief of staff.
He said that?
It was Rahm Emanuel who referred to progressives as...
Well, that makes sense because he's
retards.
His own guy, huh?
Are you talking about the retards comment?
No, I don't think... I'm a little fuzzy on this. I thought it was the press secretary chiding the progressive base for not understanding something, and I'm just too fuzzy on it to give you any more, but I could totally see Rahm Emanuel doing that and more. And I just thought, whether it was Rahm Emanuel or the press secretary, I think my reaction is the same. Why annoy the progressive base?
Because
the Republicans wouldn't do that.
Diane, it was calculated to play well to the Republicans because all of this has been about playing well to the Republicans, and they know that the progressives have nowhere else to go.
Yes, that's true. Except I just left the camp.
I understand. But that's also the operative philosophy. Do you remember when William the Bloody Crystal and George Will and David Brooks and the talking with teeth clenched crowd were invited to a silver spoons meal with the new president Obama, and they all sat down and they knew which fork to use with the shrimp, and then 2 days later he invited a couple of bloggers over for Kool-Aid and styrofoam cups and jelly beans.
Really, how insulting. But you're saying, in your view, that's just calculated. Like, we're supposed to get that exact message that we're getting.
Well, the right wing certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
We are negligible and we are not worth paying attention to.
Yeah.
And you know, who gives a damn, Diane, if we get that message? Because, after all, again, where are we going to go? Because come any given November, the choice is going to...
Yeah.
Okay, I'm kind of rambling here, but the primaries are what matters.
Yeah.
Well, by the time we get to November, you've got a choice between Dumb and Dumber, in most instances, or worse or worser. I mean, so the Senate race in West Virginia for Jay Rockefeller's soon-to-be vacant seat is between our sitting Secretary of State, Natalie Tennant, and our sitting... Second District Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito.
Both of these women.
That one.
Yeah, both, that one.
Which one laughed about the water?
Shame or Capito. And both of them are falling all over themselves to absolutely embarrass and abase themselves before the coal industry.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm and you know, the argument being made for the Democrat Natalie Tennant is that, well, she won't be as bad as.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe on a good day, if the wind's blowing right, she might speak up for a woman's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
I wouldn't hold my breath.
Me either.
Wouldn't it be funny if it's just the reverse, that actually, who's that one that laughed? The Republican. What if the Republican ended up better than the Democrat? I mean, to me, anything could happen in that scenario.
Well, not
when
in,
people are groveling like
no,
that.
Not in that race. Not in that.
No. Okay, you would know.
Yeah, not in that. Yeah, and of course, there's my congressional district, where a guy who started out a Republican and then ran for the legislature as a Democrat and then quit being a Democrat and became a Republican again in order to run against Nick Joe Rahal, who has at least always been a Democrat. But both of those two are falling all over themselves to see how many coal industry toes they can suck before November.
Oh, and you know, West Virginia, all the way here in Kansas, my heart hurts when I hear you talk about what you're going through, because I live close enough to it, you know, with living in the burg all that time, and I drove through West Virginia a couple of times, and it's very sweet.
It's stunningly beautiful.
Yes, and there's a sweetness, and it's just, you all don't deserve it. You don't deserve what's been happening there, and it's been happening a long time, I do understand. And we should be ashamed, but there's no one to be ashamed, apparently, you know. I remember one night you said that, you know, in getting signatures for the AIC Act, that there's like a kind of some kind of gentlemanly thing where senators from other states won't necessarily sign on to an act that affects their...
Right. It's that nasty old concept of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y.
Really, it extends that far. They can't think of what's good for the whole. They have to be parochial like that. That's really a thing there. That's really standing in your way, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've gotten kind of uppity about it in the long run.
Good.
I mean, I've looked at a couple of staffers and said, so it's okay with you if we keep dying, as long as you don't offend your relationship with Joe Manchin or Mitch McConnell. Great. I got it.
Well, you know, I'm a peaceful person, and I've studied reform and radicalism in the U.S. to some extent, just, you know, taking courses and populism, progressivism, and I'll be damned if I can think of what it's going to take to move the needle even a bit now, really. Because if you can't shame people, if people don't care, and if they're so individualistic, they can fall into that black hole. And, I mean, it just seems like all, you know, it just, well, I'm saying the same thing as many others. All the levers of change have been frozen or broken. But I, you know, then I look at what happens if there's a spark. And, I mean, are people just going to not be angry and express that? It's happened before. So, but, you know, I also take very seriously what you have said. I know it's true, is that the same people who caused these things will not be the ones to suffer if and when violence breaks out. That seems pretty obvious.
Absolutely not. And to the extent that I referenced Spain a little bit earlier, Diane,
mm-hmm.
there is a lesson to be had, and that is this.
Yeah.
Spain never had a violent overthrow of fascism. They simply tried to transition away from it after Franco died. On the other hand, because if you try to overthrow fascism, fascism will come down on you like a rock.
Mm-hmm. That's why we keep our heads down a bit. Yeah.
On the other hand, the Soviet Union, people rose up. and it came clattering to a halt because it could no longer economically sustain itself.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, there, I think there's a lesson there. I don't. Some days I think we can achieve social change. Other days I think that there are things that have to happen in front of any effective social change movement. Because, you know, right now we're in the middle of telling ourselves, Diane, that we're all going to learn something from Ferguson about militarized police and blah, 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 blah. Well, I remember in the days following the Sandy Hook massacre how we were all going to finally learn something about the nature of our gun-mad culture. And la, 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 and nothing happened.
I wish we weren't such a big country. You know, I mean, geographically. You know what I mean? I just think we're so big that
no one can
think of each other, you know, another person or another place. It's just too big and unmanageable.
And you know what? Hamilton and Madison were talking about that very topic when it was 13 little states.
I see.
If you, in fact, if you were to correspond with Dr. Bill O'Brien, you know, who does the American History Program.
Oh, yes,
I've listened to
some of his programs. Excellent.
He would probably go back and go over that again, because there is an open question as to whether or not the republic that they contemplated would be manageable on a large geographic scale. And, of course, the origins of democracy lie in the ancient Athenian city-state, which itself transformed into empire before it even knew it had. Then was easily toppled, or relatively easily toppled, given the years involved, by Sparta and by the people who lined up alongside Sparta because they were sick to death being bullied by Athens, the Athenian democracy. Remember, Plato and Aristotle despised the very concept of democracy. Because it was ruled by rabble, and the rabble killed Socrates.
Yes. And you know what? I read that he, I'm not saying he went to his death willingly, but I was doing a little research in what the social contract as an idea has meant through time. Just a little research. I understand what it meant during the Enlightenment more, like Adam Smith and Rousseau and Hobbes, you know, all that. But I read recently in a valid source that Socrates justified his death using social contract reasoning, saying, well, I have gotten, you know, using that social contract reasoning of reciprocation, you know, like two-way street kind of thing. He said, according to what I read, he said that I have gained so much from the city-state that I willingly accept the state's decision, something like that.
Yeah, because his students and followers were already to bust him out and take him somewhere else. And he told them, no, absolutely not. And it's interesting, you know, they talk about the cup of hemlock, and he said, I will not have this cup pass from me. And that's one of those little religious moments when you kind of wonder about the culture that Yeshua came up in.
Right.
Because, like, Father, right, let this pass cup from me, but
exactly
if it be thy will.
Exactly what I was thinking when you said
and
that.
And see, all of his day laborer work was done in a town called Sepphora in Palestine, which was a Hellenic city that had been thoroughly Hellenized. So it was not unlikely that he heard I'm sure you know, Koine Greek spoken, and it would be not unusual that you would hear Socrates discussed.
So that's, you're talking like street Greek?
Yeah, Koine, yeah. Gutter Greek. You know, it's not Homer.
Yeah.
And you would naturally hear things like Socrates, you know, because Socrates is the one who first comes up with the argument that the highest form of love is to love thine enemy. It's in the Symposium, somewhere after Alcibiades gets done making a pass at Socrates. He goes into what is love, what's the highest form of love, and he comes up with love your enemy.
At one of those parties, I don't know, they call it a party.
A symposium.
Symposium, yeah. Well, that has really come into the academic world, you know, when we have
Well, no, I just like the ancient Greek idea better.
Oh, you're an expert in that
time period. You know, try it sometime.
Pleasure to hear.
Next time, Diane, that somebody suggests a symposium, out there in academia where you are. Ask them how many gallons of wine they want you to bring. And are they prepared to elect a president of the symposium to direct what the topic will be? And the first decision the president has to make is how much will we water the wine?
You know, you're bringing up this picture. I am in the Society of Business Ethicists. I serve on the editorial board of the Business Ethics Quarterly, but I come out of management and social science. You know, like an economist who got into corporate social responsibility. There's a different path, but a lot of my colleagues are philosophers. And what you're reminding me of, and so they always go back to Socrates, you know,
mm-hmm.
and know things that I don't know about that. I always go back to Adam Smith. So, but we all get along and we share and we build. Well, we do what scholars are supposed to do, in terms of like kind of cross-fertilization of thoughts and
oh,
all
I
that.
Oh, I love academia.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to be in the middle of it. But when you said about the wine, it reminded me that one year, for some reason, we had the Society for Business Ethics meeting in Las Vegas, and it's because the Academy of Management was meeting there, too, so they wanted to have two conferences there at once so we could, you know, go to each other's sessions. But I had never seen such a horrible place as the midst of Las Vegas and a bunch of ethicists running around during the night playing the slot machine.
Red, no, black.
And drinking wine. I was with them, you know, but I was just like, you know, this, I was a younger scholar and newer to those conferences, and I just thought, I saw, you know, but when you were talking about the wine and the symposium and all, I'm like, I just flashed a picture of those somber.
Oh no, you're killing me here. I've got a mental image now, Diane, of some ethicist standing there with the bones in his hand, hollering, "Come on, nine, Daddy needs a new set of morals." You know,
you're not too far off. I was playing the slot machines because there was so much stimuli. You know, you just can't get sleepy and
oh, they pump
and
oxygen.
I thought, this is a horrible
I've been told by a number of people they actually pump more oxygen
oh,
into the
probably.
Room.
Probably. Yeah.
So that you stay because you can and that or they're just not putting any liquor in the drinks. I'm not sure which. But you can stay there and play and not get drunk and oh my God, you know.
But the picture of all those ethicists, you know, we're all in one place and it happens to be where we're gambling and drinking. And these are like, you know, people of note. I mean, and they're not flamboyant people, but it's just where we were placed that year kind of by the conference, planners or whatever. And, excuse me for having that flash in front of my eyes, but I have never wanted to go back to Las Vegas. I'll just leave it there. I mean, the land outside of, you know, the dam, Hoover Dam, I mean, all that. Apparently you have a dam that size in your state.
Bigger.
I can't, it's hard to believe. I do believe you,
though. Holds back somewhere between 7 and 9 billion gallons of toxic waste.
Oh, God. And how long is that going to hold, Bob?
You know, we don't know.
Uh-huh. Mm. Well, anyway, I just didn't, and I think one of your callers, Jim 1 or 2, I don't know which how that identification goes, he spent a lot of time in Las Vegas, and I think once or twice I've heard him say something about that. I just don't know how people can live with such fan. I mean, I know people have to work and all that, but I don't know how people can like all that who go into those buildings and gambling buildings every day. I guess if you worked there, like maybe Jim did, you'd get used to it. And I don't even know if Jim worked there. But to me, it was jarring. But maybe it's because there were all these ethicists running around, and I just couldn't get over that.
That's hilarious. That is absolutely hilarious. Diane, thank you for everything. This has been a magnificent conversation this evening.
I've had a ball. I just called to report on the scenario in Manhattan, but, boy, we've covered a lot of territory, and I do appreciate it, Bob. Do appreciate it.
Well, you be well, and just, you know, keep an eye on things out in Kansas for us and report back on a PRN basis, you know, as
okay.
needed.
Will do.
I look forward to hearing from you again, Diane. Take care.
Thank you, Bob. Again.
My pleasure. Bye now. Diane from Kansas, Stan. We get a lot of notes from her, but seldom a phone call. But I tell you what, when she does call in, she makes it count for a fact. Thank you, Diane. Thank you very much. I guess let's just check in real quick with the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. Hopefully we'll connect in a moment.
Hello.
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 Larry, I got you, Larry, and I've got you, Steve.
Steve, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That was an interesting conversation.
Wasn't it just a delight?
Yeah.
I'm waiting to see if Sparky connects. You there, Sparky?
Come on.
There he is.
Did you do that, Bob?
Yeah, I did. Because there's so little time left. I just thought I would pop in long enough to just get reactions on the conversation with Diane and see if anybody had anything that was on the agenda that needed to be dealt with in the next 9 minutes.
Okay, well, let me say, great call, Diane, and I've got something for you, Bob.
Okay.
If you want to use it, where's your fundraising?
We are at $250.
How much is this?
Yeah, to go. That's the whole.
Subscription cost.
Come on, you, real quick. Oh. Hang on, Larry. This will be real quick.
Okay.
As you know, I'm sending you a package on Monday.
Yes.
And I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. I already told you what I was going to send you, but they're jalapeno pistachios.
Holy cow.
How cool.
I'll get religion over that.
I'm putting $100 in there, and it's a double down challenge.
Okay.
You have to match my challenge dollar for dollar and send Bob your information, and I will send you some jalapeno pistachios if you match my challenge.
Grown right there, not far from you, right?
Right down the road, about within 40 miles.
Wow. So that's a great way. We are a
little town called Artois, California.
Artois?
Artois.
Wow. Oh, those are going to, well, I for one am very self-centered on this. I can't wait to taste them. Ferg will go out of his mind, and the girls will probably run screaming into the next room.
Ouch.
But wow, yum. So that's the double down challenge. And if people will match what you just did.
Yeah.
And
now to the end of the month.
Okay. Let's make it over the weekend.
Okay, whatever you want to do.
Yeah. So over the weekend, anybody who wants to match Sparky's double down challenge, Sparky will then turn around and send you some shockingly fresh jalapeno pistachios. And, you know, just send me the mailing address you want them to go to, and it'll happen. Wowzer. That's a big help with the hole, too. So anybody ever had fresh jalapeno pistachios? Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. Jump right in.
They may not be that fresh, Bob. They're packaged.
You know what? They're going to be fresher than I ever buy.
Okay.
They're going to be fresher than just about anybody between California and Iran ever get.
And you'll get them in a Spider-Man package, priority mail from the U.S. Postal Service.
Ooh, Spider-Man.
Nice.
Yeah, so that challenge is on the table, and at $250 to go in fundraising, a couple of double downs will get us out of that. Will get us out of that spot. So thank you very much, Sparky.
We have to match $250.
That no, not 250.
$100.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's amazing. Thank you, Sparky. And didn't you say? Well, we're not going to add this into the challenge, but that's the cheese is made with those ghost peppers.
Yeah, that's going to be in there.
Wow. And you said it was it brought the sweat out on your forehead?
Yeah. I didn't eat as much as my stepson did.
It sounds like your stepson is kind of fearless where that's concerned. That's how we are with hot stuff around here.
I'm going to put it in the mail Monday, and I'm going to say put it on the fastest pony and get it to West Virginia.
Put it on the speed snail.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, I thank you, Sparky. I thank you very much. And just as a reminder to folks, the Horn Malloy Skype chat group will be going in full swing shortly after midnight, after the close of Malloy's Friday program, correct?
And we have a whole bunch of people that you've never heard on Friday on the Front Porch with Bob.
And so anybody wanting to jump in, just send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Sparky Dunk, and you too can be a part of the zany, merry, post-midnight Eastern time gathering that is the Horn Malloy Skype chat group.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Sparky. Thank you. Thank you for being there. Sergi, thank you, Larry, and thank you, Steve. Hey, like I said before, thank you, Sergi, for posting that little mini rant on Pastor Hagee and for sharing it over to my Facebook page. I think folks will get a big kick out of it if they never heard it before. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So there we find ourselves at the end of a broadcast week and at the end of this Friday on the Front Porch. Thanks again to Diane for a magnificent conversation. It was absolutely a joy, and it goes to show the operating philosophy behind the horn. We're not kidding when we call this conversation radio. It really, really is. Thanks all week long for everybody who's helped us keep paying the bills. It really is important. It really is what keeps this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the horn chat room. Thank you, Sparky, for your longtime service as moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia for all of his technical expertise. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have an absolutely wonderful weekend, everybody.